Welcome to Living Queer, where we explore what it means to be queer in today's world. I'm your host, Erwin De Leon, and today we're joined by my very good friend, Odell Mays, a longtime LGBTQ+ and HIV/AIDS activist and community leader. Odell is also a sought-after consultant with over 30 years of management experience in nonprofits and board leadership, including as a founding board member of the American LGBTQ+ Museum, as chair and co-chair of the board of Gay Men's Health Crisis, and as treasurer of the New York City LGBTQ Community Service Center. And lest I forget, he also teaches at Columbia University and NYU. Odell, did I forget anything?
I think you've about covered everything, Erwin. Those are my highlights.
So what's the latest? What's your latest project? What's keeping you occupied nowadays?
There are a couple of things keeping me occupied. My practice is thriving, and I'm very happy about that. There's more than now a need for seasoned professionals who are steeped in nonprofit management to come to the forefront and really assist organizations in being resilient and thriving during these times. And so I'm seeing, you know, a lot of movement in that, which is great because I love the work. I'll start with the end of the story as opposed to the beginning.
This past
weekend, I had I attended a wonderful retreat with my colleagues on the American LGBTQ+ Museum. We had a weekend retreat, our fourth, up in Armonk, New York. And people flew in from all over the country, and it was just an extraordinary experience. As most retreats, we had focused work that we had to do, but it was also just joy being in fellowship with people of a like mind who understand the importance of us telling our stories. Mm-hmm. And so the museum is really taking on much more of a legacy and passion project for me in a way that even I'm surprised, because I've been such an activist for such a long time.
Mm-hmm. Your words.
Right.
Not mine.
But just being able to connect in that space and being able to do that is really, you know, been quite rewarding. So that's the main piece of my community work that I'm really
looking into. And you have a book in the offing as well.
A book in the offing. My years of teaching nonprofit financial management coming to my version of a capstone. Myself for my education experience and leadership. It's a book on nonprofit financial management that I'm co-authoring with two colleagues from Columbia. And it really is serving as a blueprint and resource guide for nonprofit leadership and nonprofit boards and students who are in nonprofit management curriculum and degree programs. So it really has a multi-pronged approach to it, but I'm excited. It's the first book that I'm co-authoring, and we're having a great time putting it together. Hopefully it'll be out the early part of next year.
Well, not soon enough for when I teach financial management come January, but perhaps I can use it next after
Absolutely.
That. So great. You started with where you're at right now in your work on behalf of the LGBT community, but can you tell our listeners, how did it start?
Wow, you want me to really go back?
The overview, the brief version, cliff notes, bullet points, or, you know, major points.
Fair enough. So my community work started in earnest after I moved to New York in 86 to go to graduate school. I went to NYU, got my MBA, and, you know, was going to do what most MBAs do, which is go work on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. At that point. And while I was in graduate school, I came out mm-hmm. as a gay man, and it changed my life. Mm-hmm. It literally changed my life. Mm-hmm. So the idea of coming into my own and being all of who I was became sort of my North Star. Mm-hmm. I did corporate work for a short period of time, realized it was soul-sucking. For me.
For you. We of listeners who are
exactly for me. Yes. I understand it. I got it, but it wasn't what my spoke to my heart. And so I pretty much left the corporate world and gravitated toward, at that moment, HIV/AIDS work. Mm. First in a volunteer capacity with God's Love, where I was a volunteer for 12 years. Mm. And then through that, getting involved at the LGBTQ Center and other organizations, but really focused on HIV and AIDS early on in the epidemic. So I'm one of those frontline warriors from the ACT UP days and people who moved in that circle in terms of bringing the importance of HIV AIDS.
So were you at that protest at St. Patrick's?
I was actually not at that protest, but I have many colleagues and old friends who were photographed in the whole bit. But I was actually away when that protest happened. I wasn't in New York City. But yes, those were some of my people.
Right. Well, those were different times, right? In terms of protest. Yeah. And well, as we both know, these are challenging times right now for the community. But how does this moment figure in the arc of the LGBTQ movement, right? I mean, looking again at your history beginning with the HIV crisis and throughout the years.
Yes. I have a couple of different perspectives. My first is as rooted in my identity as a Black man in this country.
Okay.
And so there are eerily similar issues and feelings around the place of race and how this country has not had its reckoning and come to deal with it. So everything old is new again and everything new is old again. It's I'm not surprised by a lot of the backlash, especially around DEI and things like that. But it's disheartening because it reminds us of how much work there is to do as a society in terms of ensuring that all experiences that people have are valid and respected, even if they're not your experiences. I think there is a lot of similarity specifically around HIV/AIDS crisis at its height and today's political environment in terms of the discourse. Mm-hmm. Very divisive and very much a judgmental. Mm-hmm. Either you're one of us or you're not.
Right.
And if you're doing something that is not like one of us, then that makes you a bad person.
Right.
That narrative, unfortunately, has reared its head. It never went away, but it's come back with a vengeance in a way that I find incredibly disturbing and upsetting.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me see. There are two ways I could go about this. Well, you mentioned the issue of race, and actually I'll jump to that question that I have because I interviewed you for my ongoing research on LGBTQ+orgs, how they are faring under the current climate and where they're headed. And when I used the term queer people of color, you challenged the use of people of color as a catch-all for everyone who's not white.
Absolutely.
So maybe let's dive into that. How should we be talking about the different identities, right, that fall under LGBTQ, under people of color, BIPOC, however we say, all these umbrella terms?
Yeah.
And what are the implications, right, for the work?
Absolutely. I tell you, I have used the term BIPOC in people of color, and I understand its relevance as a shorthand and collective, an umbrella term. However, at the same time, I'm very aware of how it also dilutes and distills individual community experiences as sort of this, we're all one. Mm-hmm. And I think in order for us to be really united as communities who aren't totally white identified, we need to also be able to realize and accept that we have differences even among ourselves. Like not all Black people are the same. Not the Black experience is not the Latino or Latinx experience. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. So I think that we, meaning the people who are part of this people of color collective, need to be really clear that even within that, we have very unique experiences.
Right.
And so when I talk about my work and my experience, I am very front and center with folks that I did this as a Black man, first and foremost. And that the way that I view the world is not a collective people of color perspective. It's the perspective of an African-American whose ancestors were slaves and sharecroppers. And so what does that feel like and look like from where I sit in my shoes is going to be very different than even other Black Americans or other Black folks who come here who migrate. So I think the idea of people of color is, in my harsher moments, I feel like it's a cop-out. I feel like it's a way of people just to say, we're going to lump everyone together and we will have to have discussions about anything deeper than whether you're Black or you're white, whether you're white or something else. Well, I think we need to have those discussions. Part of what makes this country incredible in some ways is the diversity of people's backgrounds. So I don't want to lose that. So I tell people, I think that, you know, we need to start owning the fact that if we're going to have conversations about Black queer folks, then have that conversation. If we're going to have conversation about Latinos, have that conversation. You can always bring those groups together, but have the conversations about what does it feel like for you, looking how you look, to move around in this country.
So it is a dialogue. It's not just someone belonging to a particular group, as it were, educating someone, but actually talking to each other, right? So
always.
Like, how do you envision that, like, in the organizational setting, or even as individuals, right? Let's just say I identify as Asian American, Filipino American. And so if we met for the first time, or maybe not, where we've known each other all these years, but how might we move to that space first as individuals and as organizations, LGBTQ orgs in particular, right? We will get into the LGBT, but we're just talking about even the racial, ethnic identity within our queer community.
That's a great question, Erwin. And from my perspective, I think the underlying connector for me, for you being Asian American, Filipino descent, me being African American, and very clear about that, the underlying connection is a sense of otherness in the space and place that you call home. And if you aren't white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, you know, WASP, or clearly white in that regard, you are an other when it comes to this country.
Yes.
And so if I see you on the street, there's going to be an automatic, for me, a connection there. The devil is in the details, in the dialogue that happens, which is really us getting to know one another. We can talk about not only our shared experience of being other, but also how our individual experience has shaped and molded the way we move through surviving in this country or not. So I think that it requires time. And unfortunately, people don't want to invest time in having the conversations that they need to, either because they don't think they're important or they're afraid or any number of things. But it's hard to do it. It takes time.
Right.
To have conversation and dialogue. And you need all parties to participate. And that also becomes a challenge, especially when you look at organizing. And what does participation and organizing look like in various communities? And how does it manifest itself? There is no one size fits all for organizing.
Wow. Yeah. And that clarity amplifies or expands to organizations, right? Because even within the LGBTQ world, there are orgs that specifically address, well, first BIPOC, but then some purely Latina, Latinx, or Black or African American.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So all this, which actually in a way leads me, to my question about one thing that I have heard, and I do know from experience, is that, you know, even the LGBTQ space, you've got the L, the G, the P, the Q, right?
And the plus,
The
there are many
plus.
other, there are many, right?
So what do we do about that? Particularly, I think it's so easy to say that, particularly at this current moment, we have to stand together. We have to work together against the common enemy. I'm doing air quotes here. But how do you do that exactly, right?
Yeah, I think it's it, that's a great question. I think that we need to understand the labels, the L, the G, the B, the T, the Q, the plus, but not get stuck with the labels. And so what I mean by that is all of those labels are a way of identifying those, and I'll use my turf favorite word again today, which is the othering, the other of the experience. And so I think regardless as to what you want to call it, what you're really talking about is the idea of not being like everyone else. And acknowledging that and moving with that being an understanding, a clear understanding and a baseline, I think it's going to be really important, especially in the LGBTQ plus community. I know folks love the word queer. I'm of a generational thing where queer is not what resonates with me. I totally understand the word queer. And I am, if someone were to use and describe me as being a queer Black man, I would not have a problem with that. But again, because of my age and my where I sat in all this history, I identify as being a gay man, which is also valid because that's how I see my world. And so I think being able to give ourselves permission not to get too stuck and hung up on the whether it's the L, the G, the B, the T, the Q, the plus, will go a long way. We're trying to, I know we're trying to include everyone, which is why we have the plus. We've got other things that need to be included that are othered. But I think that we don't want to spend, I don't want to spend my energy and time debating the validity of the letters. Because it misses the point to me. The point is that we're othered.
And I guess in some way is allowing, that the word grace is used a lot nowadays.
It
But
is.
there's value in that. And I think even
I
within our
love
community, correct? We need to allow that, making
it.
mistakes. With, I think I shared with you before we started recording how I've mislabeled someone who identifies as non-binary, right? But
Right. And I think that, and to your point, yeah, great. I think grace is used a lot, but I totally believe in grace. And so I don't think it can be overused or oversupplied to people, given to people. Yeah, I think that if someone has a particular stance about how they view their world and their experience and they ask to be identified that way, by all means, respect that. Do it. If you make a mistake, misidentify someone, it's not the, I don't want to say it's not the end of the world, because that almost makes it sound like it was never that important in the first place. But I do want to say that it's put it in the context of the issue, which is the othering of other societies and other experiences at the expense of those groups.
Agreed. Absolutely. So if I may go back to, back to history. If I could turn back time, I'm not going to do my Cher impersonation.
Please don't.
I need my full drag to do
I want the entire share look. If you're going to do
that.
share, you got to give me all a share. Okay.
Okay, maybe in our next interview when this is a when it's video recorded. Seriously though. So we started talking about, the height of the HIV/AIDS crisis, and that was really serious. It's an understatement, right, for the community. But people always remember it as a time when the community came together, right? When lesbians, for the most part, right, took care of gay men who were dying. And now we find ourselves where our trans and non-binary siblings are under attack.
Yep.
Is it similar? I mean, do you, in the sense that
yes,
are we coming together?
I think there are similarities, but I want to, as much as I do acknowledge that there were definitely elements of the LGBTQ community that pulled together in extraordinary ways during HIV/AIDS, there were also glaring omissions of folks, especially if you go back and read the history of the movement. And so people who look like me are not featured prominently in that history, and yet we were there doing the work too. So I think that, and it's the same way now in some ways with trans and non-binary folks. If you look at the folks who get targeted, a lot of them look like me. And yet not everywhere in the community is there a uniform call to action about how to protect folks. Not because they're trans in some ways, but because we haven't come to terms with, and I'm going to go back to this, to race and ethnicity in some ways. And so as much as there was a coming together around HIV and AIDS, I think there are opportunities to parallel some of that existence, but I by no means want to make it seem as if we all came together. Because Black men were not included at those early tables.
Yeah. Even the images that one would see, actually, it's because I was just reflecting on that. There weren't a lot of images of Black folks.
Yeah. And yet we were doing the work.
You were, absolutely. You were there, as were many others.
Yep. And so it's, and for those of us who survived, it's kind of disheartening in some ways to look back and see, wow, this is like endemic. This is actually how this country has told its narrative, by erasing others and filling in with something else. And so we see that even in our movements, that we've used tools that have actually been used against many of us. We've used them against one another in some ways.
So it goes back again. How do we acknowledge that? How do we address it? How do we move past it within our community? Because going back to even just service delivery or program delivery by LGBTQ orgs, it has real implications, because even within the community, who has access to the resources?
Absolutely.
And who are the people donating or controlling the funds?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think in service delivery in particular, you've got and still have in many spaces a disconnect between those who need the service and those who provide the service.
And fund the service.
And yes, and definitely, clearly, thank you. Clearly, and those who fund the service. And so if you can't talk about how those players look different and may have had different experiences based on how they look, if we can't even have that conversation and acknowledge it, not because I need for you to do anything about it, I need for you to be able to say that it is true and validate the fact that it was my experience growing up as a Black guy in the South or anywhere else.
Right.
So I think if we can't even have those conversations, then I don't think you move past it, because you can't talk about it. So I am one of the less optimistic about the fate and direction of this country, because I realize how ingrained it is for us, for Americans, not to talk about things. Not to talk about things. And it seems to be, not seems to be, it is a problem.
Yeah, it's a toughie for sure. Which reminds me of something you also said when I interviewed you. I'll you quote here. You said that we need to rediscover the art and act of organizing. Close quote. Why and how and who to organize?
You want me to have all those answers?
Yes, please. In one sentence or less.
I can come up with the tagline. I don't have the answers. I have the quote. But I'm very quotable, but I don't necessarily have the answers. I think that the act of organizing is part relationship and human nature, mm-hmm. and authenticity, and part science. Mm-hmm. So we've got to be able to understand who we're trying to talk to and what we're trying to say and what we're asking of people to organize about in ways that resonate. Mm-hmm. Knowing that you can have the same overall message, but it gets delivered and played out in a lot of different ways. And mm-hmm. so I think that we need to rediscover how to curate, how we step up to folks and who we step up to, being very clear what it is we're asking folks to do when we join together. And the more you can show, and this is why I love the word intersectionality, although it gets used in a lot of like watered down ways, Black women knew exactly what they were talking about. Mm-hmm. Even though I want you to curate your message to who I am is an intersection of a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we need to be very clear and focused about how do you speak to each of those parts of me in a way that says all of those things are related. So how you look will impact your educational experience, right. impact your ability to get educated in this country, where you can get educated and how it gets resourced. It impacts my ability in healthcare. Mm-hmm. It impacts my ability economically. So all of these places that we have, they're intersections in terms of how my experience and how I look mm-hmm. manifests itself. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to become much more creative about mm-hmm. talking about intersectionality and the importance of identifying and communicating messages that speak to individuals. Mm.
So that, in a way, touches the how, and mm-hmm. but the who or the whom. So who do we need to organize to address the current moment?
Yeah. I'll answer that two ways. One is a pure political sort of kind of based on the political structure we have today.
Okay.
I think who we need to organize are those folks who are in most cases don't look like me. Like there are white women out there mm-hmm. benefit greatly from a white patriarchal society. And don't understand how that benefit mm-hmm. also comes at a tremendous cost, not only for themselves, but for others. And so being able to speak to and organize folks who sit with privilege, but also sit with areas that can be marginalizing, getting them to see that marginalization, as long as that's there, it hurts all of us, even if you have this benefit and privilege on this side. So, you know, I think a lot of the organizing needs to be done, quite frankly, by white women and young folks mm-hmm. who really have a stake in the game and need to see that it's not a net zero sum pie that we're talking about. Taking away from one and giving to someone else doesn't diminish all of us. Mm-hmm. We need to understand that concept better. So I think the who needs to be organized is we need to continue doing our work. Mm-hmm. And me as a Black gay man, you know, you as an Asian American gay man, Filipino descent, we need to keep doing things in our community to show up and support one another. But I think there's a larger circle of organizing that needs to be done by people who don't even look like me.
Right.
So they have me organize them. Mm-hmm. Puts extra burden on me. It's like, and I'm not, quite frankly, I'm not the messenger for organizing certain groups of folks because I'm not the experience.
Correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think folks who understand it, so, you know, no matter whether you're gay or straight, no matter where you sit, if you understand that you're connected to the humanness of it all, the humanity of it all, those folks need to organize. And then when you organize as a group, partner up with folks who are already doing that work too. Mm-hmm. And I think that that piece of who is the asker? Who is the one asking for the who is the organizer and not the organizee? Mm-hmm. I don't even know if that's the word or not, but we're going to use it today anyway. The organizers need to reflect some value and some identity and some connectedness with the organizee. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think that really becomes important.
Can you think of past or present? Asker or organizer that did this well, maybe not perfectly, but embodied what you're suggesting?
Well, I can tell you I'm part of an experiment where I think that we're actually trying this, and mm-hmm. I want to think that it's successful. I'll talk a little bit about the museum, the American LGBTQ plus Museum. Mm-hmm. The effort there was to be incredibly intentional about not focusing our energy on creating like a space and place for that part of our history and culture that is already well known, mm-hmm. meaning white identified, mm-hmm. and really stepping into and having a founding board that reflects a lot of the different identities and intersections of those identities kind of baked into the DNA of the museum. We're very intentional about that. And I think it's a lot of work. Mm. It's a lot of work, but it's the work I think that will be the glue that makes the museum successful when it opens and hopefully serves as a model for how you come together as a collective across a wide diaspora of experiences to build something that speaks to the humanness in all of us, the ability to tell our story.
Yeah, I can't wait for it to open.
I can't either. It's been a labor of love. It's been 10 years that we've been working on it. Mm-hmm. And I was here at the beginning. So, and I want to make sure that gets recorded in the history books too. When your museum opens, I plan on being still on the board and hopefully we'll be able to say yes, I was the one who signed the paperwork.
Well, here it is. It's recorded. It's there.
Exactly. I'm one of the five original charters, charter members of the museum. So
wonderful.
Yeah.
So are you hopeful?
There is a piece of me that's always hopeful. Mm-hmm. It's in my nature. At the moment, I'm less hopeful than I've ever been. Just because of the cruelty and the explicit evilness mm-hmm. of so many aspects of the world today, like the deliberate cruelty. So I'm less hopeful, but there's a piece of me that I'm built with two platforms in my life, resilience mm-hmm. and aspiration. Resilience for me represents my history and my connection with my ancestors. And I use that every day to just survive. The aspiration for me represents forward-looking mm-hmm. and that I want society to be better than it is. Mm-hmm. So everywhere I can be to make that happen or be a part of that kind of work, sign me up. Mm-hmm. So that's the aspirational piece. And I sit with myself in both of those camps equally. I rely on my resilience and look to my aspiration to kind of help me see what is possible. I think that for me right now in this moment, that's as close as I get to being hopeful. Mm. It's pretty damn good, actually, but it's.
Well, if people could see you, I'm sure they can hear your energy. It comes across. It comes across, my friend. But so is it that resilience and aspiration that keeps you going? Or is there something
yes.
more?
Yes. And when I say resilience is made up not only of knowing my history and knowing my family, but it's also being connected to community. Mm-hmm. And it's also being clear about who I am, in addition to knowing who my people are. And learning from and taking note from all the lessons of folks who came before me. Some of those are my direct ancestors. Some of those are just people that I've done work with, community work and organizing over the years, who I stand on their shoulders. So that for me represents the resilience, the aspiration piece, really. And it's not for everyone. Aspiration is not for everyone. I mean, I have certain privilege because I'm educated, because I've been able to like develop, grow, experience. I've had a lot of experiences. The aspiration piece can be challenging, but I'm allowed to aspire because of my resilience. So those two things for me are very, very connected. And I think for many of us, the reason why we will be able to withstand all of the craziness that's being played out in our society is because we have that resilience.
Every day.
It's not even just about what we want to be able to do. It's just to be able to just exist.
So in closing, what would you tell our listeners, particularly our younger, yeah, in a way, selves, our younger siblings? What would you tell them?
Be true to who you are. Don't judge it. You will save yourself an enormous amount of like internal personal struggle, and hopefully become a better steward of an aspirational world if you adhere in your heart, in your soul, be true to who you are. No judgment, no tea, no shade. Be true.
Amen.
And then, yeah, live your life. Live your, if you have that truth and that clarity about who you are, live your life.
Wonderful.
Get strong in it.
Yes, I can hope for that for ourselves and for our younger siblings.
I tell you, I hope for it for ourselves because we're still here. So I think we need to be true to who we are. And it's also, yeah, definitely true for our younger selves.
Absolutely. Which, who I do see in the younger folks out there. Because some experiences still.
Absolutely. But be true.
Yes.
Be true and be clear.
Well, Odell, thank you for joining us and for your dedication and commitment to our community. Well, for listeners, you can find and learn more about Odell on his website, maze2consulting.com. Until next time, I'm Erwin De Leon, and this is Living Queer. Be strong and true, and always choose light and joy. Thank you.